SCP-8888, 8 Ball, Part 3. It would certainly be a boring piece of fiction if everything went according to plan. Sure, sometimes things seem to work out in the moment, but in the long run, there always has to be some sort of hitch to keep things interesting. So far, in SCP-8888, the plan to get the 8 Ball back seems to consist of nothing but hitches, especially considering who's on the team. Dr. Sokolsky is leading a group of misfits consisting of placeholder McDoctorate, Director Hishikaku, Doctors Moncier, Samarian, and Weddle, Researcher Harkness, and Agent S. Together, they are about to head to a casino night being held at the Wanderer's Library in conjunction with Demons from Under Vegas. Things are not going to go according to plan. Let's continue. We pick things up with the various after-action reports from Sokolsky's team after Operation Pickpocket. The operation began in Florida at an empty Planet Fitness where they begin to change into their formal wear. Agent S presents Harkness with a comically large object in the rough shape of a colander, which she was not holding moments prior, causing him to wince. She also supplies earbuds to each of the team after they change, although Weddle ends up breaking the lock on his stall, forcing Sokolsky to painstakingly extricate him from his misaligned suit and help him redress. Hishikaku then arrives as well, brandishing a hand of playing cards, which Agent S takes and remarks on them being pretty good. She asks him how he managed it, to which Sokolsky just says that he guesses he's really familiar with the library, the people who stole the 8 Ball. Hishikaku begins to growl something in response, but Sokolsky just tells him to change into his fancy clothes. Agent S proceeds to hand the cards to each team member, with them now suffused with a golden glow. She remarks in excitement about having fake IDs, and says that this is what it must be like to be a teenager sneaking into the liquor store, with both her and Sokolsky noting that they were never really teenagers. Sokolsky chooses the Ace of Clubs, Hishikaku the Ace of Diamonds, Placeholder the Ace of Spades, Moncier the Ace of Hearts. Weddle is given a Joker, causing him to close his eyes wearily, and Harkness takes a second Joker, just in case. Dr. Samarian is handed the Rules card, causing him to nod and say, fair enough. Sokolsky then also hands Weddle a gleaming red pentacle, patting it for emphasis, and tells him that this is his spending money, and if he loses it, he'll make him expendable. The team then head into a storage room in the back of the building, which contains a single treadmill marked Not for Recreational Use. Sokolsky gestures to Hishikaku, who waves his Ace of Diamonds card in front of the machine and says, knock knock. The treadmill grinds to life, and Sokolsky says for the mole to go first, but before Hishikaku can protest, he shoves him onto the treadmill, causing him to vanish. The rest of the team follow. They all emerge in the empty fitness section of the Wanderer's Library, and after picking Weddle up off of the floor and pulling Hishikaku out from a collapsed bookshelf, they proceed towards the Grand Hall. As the sound of excited voices and electronic music gets closer, Agent S separates from the group, grinning and saying that she'll be around. Sokolsky tells her to stay focused, and if their gadgets stop working, he'll be speaking in all caps to her boss. She replies that he shouldn't worry his pretty bald head, as she's an old pro, but she's not going to visit the seat of all magic without taking a few celebratory swivels as she pirouettes into the library. A bearded demon in a blood-red velour suit is standing guard at the entrance to the Grand Hall, this being Pluto, or 7 Ball. He examines the team's fake IDs carefully, nods, and allows them to pass. Sokolsky grins and says, pocket one, but Hishikaku tells him to not get cocky. Moncier remarks on him using the word get, as the team finally arrives at casino night. Back in the interrogation room with Sokolsky and Harkness, Sikorsky tells him that the North Palm Beach Planet Fitness is over a dozen kilometers from his post and is unaffiliated with the Foundation, because they are not affiliated with all Planet Fitnesses. Understandably, the police were contacted, but fortunately, Asset Recovery picked it up and made it to the scene first, sedating him. Harkness says that they must have been compromised and someone tipped off security, as the detail was tighter than the briefing said. He asks where everyone else is and if they all made it out. Sikorsky instead says that he needs to help him out, as Harkness had eyes on everyone, and asks what happened. Harkness exclaims that he doesn't know, as it was sensory overload, and as he squints up at the flickering fluorescent lights, he moans that it still is. Sikorsky tells him to take it easy, and hands him a bottle of water, as he begins to breathe slowly in and out. Sikorsky tells him to walk him through what he did after they entered the library. Harkness says that his bit was to handle the on-site security, which includes the Sofonts, which are these interlinked magical constructs that he can hack. He says that it was like hacking, but something entirely new to him, and it messed with his head. Sikorsky asks if the flash forging went as expected, and Harkness says that the lab coats explained it to him by saying that their universe is surrounded by two bubbles, and nothing gets through those layers naturally, but sometimes the layers come very close to one another. The closer they are, the easier it is to poke a hole through them for a small time, so he used the electric saw that Agent S gave him. He pauses to ask if she got out okay, which she did. And then he says he used the saw to open the potentiality space suffusing the wall behind the way. He takes a few swigs from the water bottle, commenting on how warm it is, before continuing to say that the other side was just cold, empty darkness. It felt like it went on forever, and it was terrifying, but it was still better than Florida. Agent S got him that helmet that looks like a glowing pasta strainer, though. We then cut back to the storage room at the Planet Fitness, where Harkness has just finished stringing a set of leads into the dark space behind the treadmill portal, attaching the other ends to the treadmill itself, his helmet, and a monitor. He sits down on the belt and places the helmet on his head, projecting his consciousness into the Wanderer's Library network. He sits in an upright position on the floor, back turned to the empty black hole behind him, eyes fluttering and closed, green light pouring out past his lids. He accesses the security hive mind, an interlinked web of docents providing the Serpent's Hand security with a comprehensive overview of the gaming pit, a confirmation network periodically checking each local node against the overall consensus and triggering lockdown should discrepancies arise. His high CRV allows him to penetrate the hive without assimilation, and one node at a time, he subordinates each docent's connection to the network of connected vessels into his own consciousness. This is the equivalent to disconnecting a camera from a CCTV network, but the camera is an empty vessel cut off from a network of security drones. Harkness's awareness stands in for the disconnected node, and verifies the veracity of his own doctored reports, but what he doesn't expect is that his CRV is not only higher than the cognitive influence of the Sofon confirmation network, but higher than that of the collective itself. As a result of this, he subsumes the entire network, his consciousness becoming disoriented by division between each Sofont simultaneously, and they begin to behave erratically. The security chief for the night, a senior Serpent's Hand agent known as Midnight, or Fourball, takes notice. She purrs a command, and across the library, a draft of off-duty librarians is quietly begun. In the Grand Hall, which is tightly packed with wanderers on the slowest of days, is now almost literal pandemonium. A red-skinned Wrath demoness in a Foundation-issued leather jacket is pacing the tables, striking bodybuilder poses in the eyelines of any greed demons with particularly hungry gleams in their beady eyes, to dissuade them from artificially augmenting their luck. A number of demons from a dozen different principalities do much the same, occasionally shooting jealous or suspicious glances at the apparent turncoat. Behind a commandeered circulation desk, Baal, Lord of the Flies, or Sixball, is tapping an earpiece and deploying a literally withering glare at anyone who dares interrupt him. Across the hall, surrounded by agents with stances suggesting that they are both armed and want that fact to be generally known, is Threeball, Randall House, director of Site 666. You may remember House from SCP-4661, as he handles the Foundation's site in Vegas that links to Under Vegas, a region of space connecting Vegas and the Fourth Circle of Hell. He is speaking very slowly with knitted brows to a higher demoness, who is repeating his every word and occasionally plunging one taloned finger into her ear and swizzling to improve the reception. Midnight observes the proceedings from a cushioned mat on an ivory plinth, her black fur gleaming purple in the gaudy casino light radiating from sensors hung on nothing at all. The air is dense with chatter from dozens of games from countless cultures, ages, and dimensions. A satyr with a polished name tag reading Old Scratch is overseeing a round of Devil's Grip. Two translucent creatures shaped like gumdrops the size of a human head are hovering over the shoulders of a nonplussed pride demon, lecturing him on the finer points of exploding kittens. A professional player of Fizbin flips the table and punches out both of his opponents, to the polite applause of impressed onlookers. One table's dealer is a particularly animated octopus who chides and berates his players under the watchful eyes of a pit demon pit boss. Another has only four arms and a relaxed smile, while the players at its table are staring and in two cases actually pointing daggers at each other, apparently beneath its notice. A wizened goblin gesticulates wildly at a massive hanging folds of once fattened flesh, out of which a pair of equally animated arms attempt to flail in rough response. During lulls in the argument, the Lord of Sloth pauses to attend to a can of Slim Fast, carried on an edible rice plate by an equally edible retainer, all parties wincing with disgust at every sip. A bloated ball of fur stands atop yet another table, kicking its chips into the pot, while a barely dressed succubus grins wickedly, her victory only slightly undercut when the final chip is deposited into her left eye via precision kick. The lamplight occasionally captures a light dustfall or stray playing card drifting down from the highest of the hall's high rafters, where movement in the shadows suggests an exclusive, high-altitude game of chance for the Shire set is also being hosted. It is, against and employing all possible odds, Under Vegas Casino Night at the Wanderer's Library. And with an unapologetic smile, Sikolsky shoves Dr. Weddle into the middle of it, shouting, "Bad luck." Sometime afterwards, Sikolsky is speaking to Hishikaku, calling him Mr. Robot and telling him to make it quick. Hishikaku replies that he will be reporting his version of events in full at the insistence of the Ethics Committee, with Sikolsky remarking on his version. Hishikaku says that Liaison Samarian and him had been assigned to oversee, but he's cut off by Sikolsky saying there he goes again. Back in the Grand Hall, the remaining team members leave Weddle behind and make their way to the edge of the gaming pit. Sikolsky removes a VHS copy of The Great Escape from his suit and holds the sleeve by the sides, causing the tape to fall to the floor, at which point it soundlessly dissipates into a fine coating of dust. From the angle at which Sikolsky is standing, there is now a visible tunnel running through the floor at an orthogonal angle, and after stepping into it, he disappears. Placeholder sighs and says that that's not a heist either, as it's practically the opposite. And as Samarian begins to mention that everyone in that movie dies, Monsieur gently places a hand over his mouth, telling him not to jinx things. The team proceed into the tunnel, which re-emerges from the library floor in an even dustier set of stacks far beyond the Grand Hall. Placeholder asks Sikorsky why he had to do that in the gaming pit, as it seems risky. But Sikorsky just responds that magic has stupid rules, and it's not a great escape if you can't get caught. Ishikaku falls back to speak with Sumerian, asking him why he went so pale back at the checkpoint, causing Sumerian to hesitate. He says that they were supposed to check any items that they didn't get from Agent S with her before they started, for masking purposes, but he forgot one. He pulls out a magic 8-ball from his pocket, causing Ishikaku to whistle and say that maybe Harkness prevented it from setting off the detectors. Sumerian smiles and says, maybe, asking him if he's familiar with his SCP file. Ishikaku didn't even know he had one until that vague allusion at the meeting, and Sumerian says that he's the opposite of Weddle. Ishikaku considers this for a moment before saying that he should have been 7-ball then, although that's on the other team. Speaking of which, Ishikaku remarks that he's not sure Sikorsky's entirely on theirs, but Sumerian cocks his head and says that that's the pot calling the cue ball black. In Sikorsky and Hishikaku's conversation afterwards, Sikorsky says that he's sorry he missed that exchange. Ishikaku replies that he has a lot to say about the professionalism of his team in the field, and that's all he'll say on the matter. He can read the rest in his report, if he still has clearance by then. Back to the team. A stray docent, one of the librarians that guides visitors and punishes rule breakers, steps into their path from behind an empty stack. The team freezes, except for Ishikaku, who steps forward and gestures at the rest of the team, saying that it's fine, he's handling them. Placeholder remarks sarcastically on how that's not suspicious at all, as the docent responds in a curiously familiar voice, stating, "I'm everybody. It's sick. I'm gonna throw up in my brain," before wandering off again. Sumerian steps forward to make sure it's gone before speaking into his hearbud to ask if Agent S can confirm that the docents are acting strangely. She replies that they sure are, and it's really cute. One of them just punched a guy, and she thinks that Harkness is having a hard time. Sikorsky snaps that they better get a move on then. The section of the library that they're in is clearly disused and in a state of some disrepair. The occasional break in the pocket-dimensional lining produces a mirroring effect, which is painful to observe. At several points, the team are confronted with an image of themselves reflected in the walls, and both versions studiously avoid making eye contact. After several more minutes, they reach a heavy stone portal set into a paneled wall, a disingenuous keycard reader inset by the jamb. Sikorsky prods Ishikaku, calling him Ace Hole and telling him he's up. Ishikaku sighs as he steps up and swipes his Ace of Diamonds through the reader, telling Sikorsky that the term is Ace in the Hole. Sumerian counters that he's not in the hole yet, but they'll see how his next ethics committee review goes. The team looks down a passageway lined with kiln-fired red bricks, and Monsieur asks how much they know about what they'll be seeing next. Sikorsky explains that they're moving into the under-library, but she says that that doesn't really explain anything, which he agrees, but as he says that they shouldn't worry, he's interrupted. A loud, burpy voice burbles out the name Hishi, as a writhing mass of tentacles descends on the group. There are bubbles rising from the creature's toothy maw, and when they pop, the air is filled with a smell like ethanol, rare earth elements, and Pepto-Bismol. Ishikaku blushes as the creature pulls him into an embrace, and he greets it, calling it Jerry, but says that he's a little busy. Sikorsky, however, snatches the Ace of Diamonds from Hishikaku's fingers and ushers the rest of the team through the door, quietly closing it. He passes the card to Samarian and winks. Later, Hishikaku says to Sikorsky that he promised that his abilities would be critical to the mission. Sikorsky counters that it wasn't a mission, it was an operation, and he said that he would be useful. Hishikaku replies that he would have been more useful had someone not directed Jerry to their location before the mission began. He knows how Sikorsky works, with nothing left to chance, so he threatened to sabotage his own operation just to insult him. Sikorsky, however, just responds by imitating Hishikaku, telling him that if he believes any variety of misconduct has transpired, it is of the utmost importance to Overwatch Council that he report to the Ethics Committee immediately. Hishikaku stutters without a response, and Sikorsky just says that they're done here. While the rest of the team proceeds further through the library, Dr. Weddle moves to the crowds in the Grand Hall, avoiding the games and walking around the pit floor. In the course of 5 minutes, he has accidentally accosted 17 distinct entities and 3 indistinct ones, with representatives of all 3 security forces now eyeing him. A pair of male wrath demons approach him, but the Foundation-aligned demoness intercedes, with force, telling them that weak meat's on her plate tonight. One of the demons considers making an issue of this, but a glance at his partner, who is bleeding on the floor through the crotch of his pinstripe suit pants, dissuades him. He returns to the crowd, heading in Ball's direction, as Agent Callender, or One Ball, pats Weddle on the shoulder. She remarks that it's early in the night for dancing, and Weddle replies that he's just trying to stay out of everybody's way as he picks at the shredded sleeve of his cheap suit. Callender smiles at him, which doesn't relieve Weddle due to the number, sharpness, and proximity of her teeth, and she says that that's how he wanted it to look, but she asks who his fence is and how much has he boosted so far. Weddle blinks in confusion, and she continues, asking what the take is, the scromboli, the ticky-ticky. Weddle visibly considers something for several seconds before saying that he doesn't think those last two things are anything. The demoness's face darkens further, and in a low growl, she tells him that a few junior researchers she knows are going to find out how much funnier physical humor is, but for now, he needs to give her everything he stole. Weddle looks around, seeing the wrath demon trying to talk to Ball, who is currently shouting into a large brick cell phone about Hell Firewire lag and how they need to get the game back on, as he's got souls riding on this. House is also shouting into a mouthpiece, having not noticed the smoke rising from the camp's comms equipment or the dark-skinned man with wild brown hair and a pair of comically large scissors in his hand, who is slipping away behind him. Several of the agents surrounding House are glancing in Weddle's direction, however, and Midnight is also doing so, her eyes shining bright yellow. Weddle asks Callender if everyone here thinks he's a pickpocket, and she confirms it's either that or a really bad assassin. She slaps her fist into her palm and says that this is the part where he picks between turning out his pockets or her turning out his stomach, the hard way. He asks if that's an option, which confuses Callender, and then says that he didn't steal anything, and his pockets aren't even real. He demonstrates, splitting one of his well-chewed nails in the process, and says that this suit cost him like $5, and he's just here to... something. He sighs and says that he's supposed to play, but he doesn't want to, as he's sort of famous for his luck. She nods at him and sarcastically calls him a high roller, telling him to get gaming. He begins to say that ideally he'd rather just... but she snarls at him, and he recalibrates. He says that it's not like he has much to offer, as all he's got is this credit mark. He reaches down to pat his pockets, but then realizes that he doesn't have pockets. Callender takes notice of him saying credit mark and reaches into her tank top to draw out a small glowing pentacle. She tells him that a weird pervert over there said someone dropped it, giving it to her instead of keeping it. She gestures at a man in a brown patterned suit and cap, who is presently playing a game of strip go fish in a topiaried enclosure. She shakes the mark in front of Weddle's face, asking if it's his. He sneezes, but the ambient glow turns from white to red, so she slaps it into his hands and begins moving him in the direction of the roulette tables. She tells him that she's got her eye on him, and says to not make her put her boot in him before kicking him in the rear. He stumbles into the nearest roulette table, tapping his mark of credit on a matching pentacle embossed into the wood, and presses his palm into it as he attempts to right himself. By the time he's stable again, the glow has diminished by almost half, and the dealer remarks on how they have a big spender here. Weddle's first throw deposits itself in the gasoline margarita of a gluttony demon, who responds by consuming his necktie up to the clavicle. The second loses him the entirety of his bet. He glances over his shoulder and notices Calendar is still watching him, Bale glaring balefully at him, Midnight's eyes narrowing to amber slits, and House shouting at an agent who is sheepishly taking down a banner reading Site 777. He proceeds to place a much smaller second bet, and over the course of the next half hour, he visits each of the gambling tables and devices on the floor. One result is the depletion of his mark of credit, and its transformation into a jet black mark of debit, which makes the other patrons visibly nervous, and the greed demons salivate. What follows is a series of events during Weddle's time in the Grand Hall. A man in a fine blue silk suit, square eyeglasses, and a gleaming star tie pin challenges Weddle to a slot machine earnings contest, offering to restore his lost credit to enable this. Weddle agrees, but leaves this encounter with the debit mark emitting a cloud of darkness so thick that it coats his own glasses with ash. Weddle's suit, improperly pressed, begins to shrink, and a button flies off, landing in the mouth of one of his poker opponents. They begin to choke, and in their panic, accidentally shove their chips to the center of the table. They win the hand with a 7-deuce, finally expelling the button directly into Weddle's eye. The Internal Revenue Service and Canada Revenue Agency open a joint inquiry into Weddle's finances at the exact moment he loses 20 chips after putting in only 10 and folding after the big blind. Sokolsky's Ace of Clubs inexplicably falls out of Weddle's sleeve as another player drops their hand on the floor and they retrieve the extra card by mistake. An under-Vegas pit boss, suspicious of the accident, investigates, discovering that the player possesses 5 aces. Midnight intervenes, accusing the player of forging library credentials, and they are removed from the pit to an uncertain fate in the depths of the library. 163 participants in the bingo parlor each win the same $50 Applebee's gift card, and a riot ensues. A pink-haired waitress with heterochromia is tipped 5,333 chips by a concerned patron, and she accidentally places them on a blackjack table while spilling another drink directly on Weddle's head. The dealer mistakes it for a valid bet and pays 2-3 for a win, with the dealer overpaying the bet payout by 1 chip, and the waitress doesn't correct him on any of these mistakes. Still wet from the drink, Weddle slips and falls in transit to a roulette wheel, as a refuse demon wins at roulette 24 times in a row, turning a single chip into a controlling interest in the third circle of adversarial hell. Weddle is trampled by a giant hirsute goose, with its origin unknown, and Dr. Alto Clef, present at the library on an unrelated mission, is nearly captured by security demons, but Weddle's serial pratfalling into their midst provides enough of a distraction to allow him to escape. A gambler bumps into Weddle, attempting to pick his pocket, and Harkness's Joker card, which is inexplicably present, is stolen. The card is eventually discarded by the thief, and then picked up by a Crazy Eights player who immediately wins the game. Weddle plays Go Fish, during which he issues the semantically correct instruction, Go Fish, to an opponent, who takes mortal insult due to his one-quarter Deep One heritage. On a lucky spin, Weddle wins a luxury sports car, and is instructed to sit in the driver's seat so that his photograph might be taken. As this would compromise his identity and most likely alert the library to the presence of the team, he attempts to exit the car by climbing over to the passenger side, accidentally putting it into neutral, activating the radio with his shoe, and proceeds to fall halfway out of the car's passenger side window while Milkshake by Kellis plays at full volume. After a few seconds, he ceases struggling and simply waits to be extricated. 16 separate individuals win jackpots at the slot machines during the interval before security arrives. Weddle then attempts to rest at a heater table, which immediately catches fire. The cacophony of every electronic gambling machine in the pit registering a jackpot simultaneously produces a cavalcade of fallen patrons as the floor is carpeted in coinage. Attempting to leave the pit altogether, Weddle steps on an inebriate Fey Libertine, who immediately leaps to his feet and punches Weddle in the nose. Later, when discussing the mission, Dr. Moncier notes that the Serpent's Nest is a palimpsest, meaning something which has been reused with traces of the original still remaining, often referring to documents. She says that the stone spoke volumes to her, with tail fragments bleeding into and out of each other across the underlibrary, relics of peoples long lost plucked from their context, and incorporated into one eternal archive. Placeholder mentions that there was a tunnel composed entirely of chitin, and if you touched the plates, they chittered in alien tongues. If they were telling stories, they couldn't understand them, and he doesn't know who could. Moncier suggests that perhaps the eighth archivist of the library could, as he has plenty of chitin of his own. Placeholder continues, mentioning non-Euclidean passages of weeping dripstone paved with engraved menhirs depicting gods and queens and god-queens, a stair of gleaming green crystal that sang like wine glasses on a sleepy Christmas night, and oak floorboards flanked by moldering tomes on creaky shelves. Moncier calls it salvage custodianship. And it's not colonial, but maternal. It's the mother of all libraries, ensconced by keepsakes from its departed children. Placeholder quips that it's also creepy as hell, but Moncier just continues, saying that it's disused, not forgotten, but not well trafficked either. She thinks that the library shuffles its collections about in response to demand, and the decimals in decline are remanded to the depths. The muddle of borrowed architecture coheres into a vast foyer in industrial Victorian style, towering many stories above the team and disappearing into steam. Streams of a sludgy gray binding glue pour from apertures in the ceiling into elephantine churning vats. Gleaming chrome bellows and pistons are driven by complex arrays of interlocking beryllium bronze gears on the walls. The room is lit in rich reds and oranges by a tube of flowing magma, the sheath composed of pure orichalcos, and it hums and thrums with light. Cimmerian is the first to speak, asking why a magical library needs a mechanical power plant. Moncier explains that by the time electric light and heating was invented, anything that could cast perpetual magic was either dead or gone out of the mortal planes. Machines, however, you can set and forget, even magical machines. Placeholder asks if they would have put something as valuable as 8-Ball down here with the plumbing, unguarded, but Moncier agrees that no, they wouldn't. Sikolsky examines the doors, finding the seam between them is too thin to admit even the thinnest piece of paper. He glances at Moncier, who takes out her card, taps the doors once each, and then appears to realize something before suddenly walking through the doors. The doors then open, and Monsieur is smiling brightly on the other side. She explains that there's a scrap of Apocrypha claiming the library contracted Isambard Kingdom Brunel to modernize their engineering. She recognized him in the gear arrangements up there, and says that he had some wild theories about how much work you could save if you could somehow reverse the order of cause and effect, nearly losing him all his railway contracts. Naturally, she figured that she could walk through the door and it would open. Placeholder rubs his forehead, saying that he would have never thought of that, but Sikolsky just says that he would have as he brushes past Monsieur. After another few minutes, he would have gone back for Hishikaku and tried opening the doors with his skull. Later, Monsieur recounts that from that point on, it was nothing but pipes and steam and metal grating, all of it shining like it had just been polished. Placeholder remarks that thaumic energy is pretty clean, and Monsieur mentions that it was cute how he tried to walk through the next sealed door. Placeholder just replies that long-dead engineers all look the same to him. Back in the present time of the mission, Placeholder rubs his forehead as the others consider the door, which is single rather than double this time. Sikolsky raps his knuckles on it, with it sounding thick, and there is a slit cut into the center. He considers his card carefully before Monsieur declares that she'll go first. If they need credentials to go further, there might be warning signs the rest of them won't see in time. Placeholder, his nose reddening, says that he has no arguments with that. So Monsieur places her card in the slot, and it's immediately sucked inside before the door begins sliding up into the ceiling. The tunnel beyond is carved white stone, and she raises an eyebrow at Sikolsky, who just shrugs. She steps through the door, and it slams shut behind her. Cimmerian calls out to her, and she replies with a muffled voice that she's fine, and her card came out the other side. Placeholder then follows with some trepidation, and as before, the door slams shut behind him. Sikolsky then places his card in the slot, but the floor grating beneath his feet gives way, and he falls out of sight without a sound. The card is immediately ejected, and it is visibly a joker. The grating closes again as Cimmerian stutters and Placeholder calls out asking what happened. A siren begins sounding as Cimmerian yells back that it didn't like Sikolsky's card, and he fell. Sikolsky yells through their hearbuds for them to get out of there, as they'll be sending people, or worse. As the barely audible sound of Cimmerian's hurried footfalls becomes completely inaudible, Placeholder and Monsieur push onward. Placeholder taps his hearbud, asking if Sikolsky is there, but gets no response. The two agree that he'll be all right, but they did just trip an alarm, so they're on a time limit now. As they approach the end of the stone tunnel, they see that they are also approaching a vast cistern, composed of endless bubbles of brilliant golden stone. Their tunnel meets it halfway up, and they look down at the dizzying depth. An aircraft carrier stood on one end would fit comfortably in the space, and every nook and cranny is at least partially illuminated. Inside of the space is a tremendous tiered lighthouse, the signal atop its octagonal pylon turning slowly, casting gentle arcs of light on countless other tunnels like theirs. Placeholder watches it turn for just a moment before commenting that this is a problem. Monsieur agrees, asking if this is Five Ball. He furrows his brow and says that Sikolsky said there was a sentry in the underlibrary, and this certainly qualifies. The light is orange, too, and so are real Five Balls, so yeah, he guesses so. She then asks if it looks familiar to him by any chance, but he says not particularly, and she clicks her tongue. The light is one quarter turn away from illuminating them now, and she kneels down, noting that the paving stones they have been treading on continue down the walls at a 90-degree angle. She remarks that she's pretty sure that they could just keep walking if he doesn't mind taking a step of faith. Placeholder peers over the edge and says that he always thought Euclidean geometry was plenty good enough. He takes a deep breath and says that he doesn't think they want that light to find them, though. He then raises his hands up to shield his eyes from the sudden glare alongside Mancier, and a voice booms out through the cavern. It states that, even very small, their voices carry. The lighthouse has finished its rotation prematurely and is shining its light directly on them. Mancier hisses to Placeholder that he said he was the face of the party, so Placeholder clears his throat and greets the lighthouse. He asks if he's speaking to the lighthouse or someone inside of it. It replies that he is addressing the Lantern of Ptolemy, first and second. Its lambent light pierces to the heart of all things. Mancier remarks that it's the Pharos, the lighthouse of Alexandria, and Placeholder just says, of course. He asks it if he's speaking to a wonder of the ancient world, but there's a pause, and the voice sounds moderately less confident when it speaks again, stating that it doesn't know what that is. Mancier asks if they can have a timeout, and the light perceptibly brightens before telling them to not attempt any flight. Placeholder says to not worry, as he can't fly and it's a long way down. Mancier tells him that it probably means not to run, and the lighthouse confirms it, asking if they have perhaps heard of Archimedes' Beacon. Mancier muses that she thought that was in Syracuse, before telling Placeholder that it's claiming to have a death laser. Placeholder nods and says that they promise they're not going far, and the light blinks once before the two head back down the tunnel to get away from the light. Placeholder says that he doesn't remember anything about the Pharos of Alexandria being sapient or kidnapped. Mancier smirks, telling him that he's behind on the literature. That wreckage they found in the harbor was all wrong for the period, and not nearly enough of it. They're pretty sure that the explanation of the lighthouse being destroyed by earthquakes was just a cover story by some ancient foundation or relatively less ancient library precursor. Placeholder asks what they covered up, a lighthouse standing up and walking away? Or did the Colossus of Rhodes swim across the Aegean to take it on a date? Mancier replies that the point is that it disappeared around 1000 AD, about 1,000 years after Caesar burned the library, maybe 700 after what was left disappeared. Placeholder takes her meaning, that the archivists collected the Library of Alexandria, like all the lost libraries they've been walking through tonight, and they eventually stole the Pharos as well. He wonders why they didn't just take the lighthouse at the same time as the library, and Mancier suggests that it's because the collection increased in value a few hundred years later. Placeholder realizes then, slapping his forehead, and they agree that the lighthouse has the vault inside of it, with Mancier suggesting that maybe it always did. Placeholder glances up at the beacon as though seeing it for the first time and gasps, and she smiles, saying a sentence in classical Greek meaning, "Always the great God applies geometry to the universe." Later, Placeholder says to Mancier that he can't believe he never made that connection, as he used to be the director. She replies that that's the thing about parallels, they don't intersect. Back in the present, the lighthouse calls out to them, telling them that if they are saying goodbyes, they need not be so dramatic. Their hosts are not barbarians, and at worst, you will be imprisoned within its bosom for all eternity. Placeholder says to Mancier that he has a play in mind, and asks if she's game to try. She just nods, and they walk back towards the lighthouse together. Placeholder asks it if it's good to be among its people again after all these many years. The lighthouse appears to blink and ask to what he refers. Placeholder gestures at the both of them and says that it hails from Alexandria, and they're its cousins from across the sea, Greece. The lighthouse agrees that they are welcome, and it sees the fire of Hellas reflected in their bold gambit, but it will not avail them much. It has a duty here that extends beyond mere kinship. Placeholder asks it if it serves the wanderers and the archivists of the library. It replies that it is of their flesh composed, and it also serves the legacy of the pharaohs of the Ptolemaic kingdom, their people, and the ships as ply the waves to their shores. That final duty is admittedly in abeyance at present. Placeholder then asks who Ptolemy serves, to which it responds, "None but the gods themselves." He smiles and says that that's very convenient, because he is a god. There's another pause, and the lighthouse says that he does not look like a god. He spreads his arms and remarks that it said its light pierces to the heart of all things, so get with the piercing. Not literally, but take a good long look at him and tell him who it thinks he is. He closes his eyes as the light narrows its cone to cover only him, increasing in intensity until he's little more than a silhouette. Then the light dims, almost dying, and it says that he is no god. He is no one. Placeholder visibly deflates, and Mancier pats him on the shoulder, telling him that they already knew about identity abstraction in ancient Alexandria. She then raises her voice and addresses the lighthouse, telling it that that wasn't very nice, and she insists that it apologize. It begins to say that she is in no position to insist, but she cuts it off, spreading her own arms wide, and tells it to shine its little light on her and see what it sees. The light again increases in intensity, but only for an instant before snapping off entirely. It apologizes and says that it did not know, bidding her to approach. Placeholder is quite confused as Mancier begins walking down the vertical face of the cistern, gravity apparently reorienting itself around her. Later, Placeholder notes to not bother asking her what it saw, as she won't tell. Mancier replies that you don't spend a lifetime fertiling out secrets without picking up a few of your own. The lighthouse is reverently silent as they approach, but its doors do not open. Placeholder tugs on the handles, frowns, then raises a hand to knock. The lighthouse speaks in a vaguely apologetic tone, saying that they may not enter, and there are thresholds beyond which even gods may not pass. Placeholder grumbles that that whole pantomime got them nothing, but Mancier replies that it got them not disintegrated. She examines the doors more closely with her blind eyes, explaining that they've been reinforced, thaumically. They'll only open if the Pharos wants them to, but there's probably a central ley line node in the lantern room. The glass up there is orichalcos, so nothing they can do from here will make a scratch. Placeholder muses on the term scratch before smacking his forehead again and saying that Sikorsky takes too much for granted and it's going to get him killed, as he's not Batman. He taps his earbud and asks Sikorsky if he's in the Pharos. Sikorsky responds in the affirmative in a cheerful voice, telling Placeholder that it took him long enough. Placeholder mutters that the first question a master schemer would have asked the 8-Ball is how do I keep you from being stolen? The second is how do I get you back if you are? And it told him, meaning Sikorsky, because of course it was him who asked, that every cage which can hold it was designed by it, and how to game the system. Sikorsky replies that more specifically, it told him that the system is a game. Placeholder sighs and says that scratch is a pool term for when you pocket the cue ball on your shot and the other guy gets to put it wherever he wants. The prison pocketed cue ball, probably by putting him into probability space, and alerted the library that a major threat had appeared and been captured. Naturally, the library stuck him where he couldn't do any harm, inside the Pharos, right in front of the vault. Sikorsky finishes by saying that that vault has a lock the size of a dump truck tire covered in just about every mythological symbol you can imagine, which he hasn't got the faintest idea how to open. Other than that, though, he thinks that this was a damn fine plan. Placeholder realizes then that Weddle was wrong, and that's why he called himself Q-Ball. Sikorsky remarks that Placeholder should have seen that coming, but Mancier asks why he didn't just explain the whole plan to them ahead of time. He replies that they would have known then, and then the library might have figured it out from them. The library has patrons who can sense a burning secret, and other than him, only Harkness has a registered CRV strong enough to resist them. Placeholder asks if he told Harkness then, to which Sikorsky laughs and says no. Mancier shakes her head and says that let's say that they can brute force, broken telephone their way through that puzzle in there, and they get the vault open. Sikorsky will still be trapped. Sikorsky replies that he's not playing keep talking or nobody gets the eight ball for an hour. The two of them are coming in there themselves. Placeholder blinks in confusion and asks how. Sikorsky explains that the library didn't put him back on the table after he scratched, because it doesn't know the rules of pool. It put him in another pocket. The library scratched, and since he knows that it's listening, he would like it to place him in the lantern room, and to try not to commit another foul while it's at it, because he did come here with a list of potential stretch goals. There are no sounds of note for several seconds, and then the doors swing open. We're given another transcript of some enigmatic footage, but I'll take the time to mention a translation error I made in the previous part. The coded text from the previous enigmatic footage was in octal, not decimal, and actually read, "Attempt movement, no response. Attempt interface, no response. Attempt empathize, no response. Redundant verification complete. Course correct. Commence machination." Thanks to user Jamie7367 for pointing that out. This piece of enigmatic footage begins with it looking out from a nest of clockwork and chaos, ordering its surroundings with the cool light of reason. It sits on the deck of a mighty trireme, sails furled, surrounded by the bustle of nautical preparation. Hero of Alexandria, famed inventor, directs his workmen on the deck, shooting occasional proprietary glances at its unblinking eye and smiling enigmatically. Said eye is rimmed with mechanical implements, foreign and supplementary and engaging, obscuring little but signifying much. It sits on the stern. It will be in control. It will plot the course, as is its nature and purpose and infallible skill. There is a library on one horizon, and to the sea, a lighthouse on the other. They are kin, these three. An ersatz Diogenes approaches from the wharf. The workmen do not notice. Hero does not notice. He is aged and weathered, and his face is asymmetrically scarred. He is looking directly into the eye. He, too, is smiling. Its vision swims. It is still on the deck. The deck is awash. The damage is done. There are fish. They, too, are curious. They approach. Another coded message here reads, "Attempt empathize. Result sustain." There are materials to hand. They are not the same as steel and glass and copper beryllium, but they will serve, as it does, as it always will do, whether it wishes to or not. With that, we're nearing the climax of this heist story. Sikorsky, Placeholder, and Mancier are in front of the vault containing the eight ball. Weddle is having a ball of a time at casino night. Hishikaku is in the loving embrace of a creature named Jerry. Harkness is busy projecting his consciousness into the library's network, and Cimmerian and Agent S's whereabouts are currently unknown. So far, the plan has gone reasonably well, but we know, of course, that it won't end that way. Things are about to take a turn for the worse, so stay tuned for the thrilling conclusion of Operation Pickpocket in Part 4.